The Spinoff Podcast Network.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. The Investment Fix Podcast. Tune in today.
The Fold is brought to you by oOh!media, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Nau mai, hoki mai ki a The Fold, e mihi nei, ko Duncan Grieve tōku ingoa. My guest today is Bill Curtin, who has a voice you will almost certainly recognise. He's narrated a whole bunch of New Zealand's kind of most iconic sort of factual reality observational documentary shows, like Neighbours at War, Renters, Motorway Patrol. There's just a whole list of shows that he's worked on where you might have heard his voice, but he's worked as a field director or a post director in all kinds of kind of crucial roles in cutting together the footage, assembling the story out of your hours of footage that made a whole strand of New Zealand's shows in that vein come together. I personally have a theory, I suppose, that these are some of our most underappreciated works of television. They're the kind of shows that particularly like a critical canon might not even review, or if it did, it would review it very disdainfully. But to me, that window into the sort of ornery, kind of feisty, a bit weird New Zealand character that came through in Neighbours at War in particular, but actually in all of those shows, that is who we are as a people, and sometimes television can just give you an idealised or a sanitised version of that. So I think to have these kind of mass, super popular shows that presented us with less of a polish, that it feels really valuable to me. So I'm having Bill on today. The hook is that last Friday was the 30th anniversary of Greenstone Television. Bill has spent over half his career working with that company, and you know, he describes it pretty well near the end, this kind of quietly very successful company that has just delivers over and over these beautifully made shows about these slightly strange characters that perform really, really well for networks. It does a lot more than that, but I just wanted to get Bill on to drill into that particular vein. So this is a huge part of his career, has been spent in television, grappling in one way or another with who we are as a people, not necessarily when we're at our best, but certainly a facet of us as New Zealanders. But why I've wanted to have him on the show for a long period of time is that he's worked in parts of five decades and has a 40-year career that spans radio and television. And prior to his move into television, he spent a long time as a crucial figure at BFM during the real glory days of that organization. If you've listened to this podcast a lot, well, I'm sorry. But also you'll have heard frequent reference to the kind of glory days of BFM, because I think it was a really important media organization, and a lot of the talent who went through there, you know, the likes of Jeremy Wells, Paul Casserly and so on, still have kind of really crucial roles to play in some of our biggest productions to this day. I think it taught you things about making television that was both professional, kind of did what it needed to, but also had just enough that was slightly odd that it elevated from where it, you know, from a more humdrum product. So we spent a significant chunk of time talking about that, and actually about his pre-history, pre-BFM history, making radio in Belfast and Whangarei. And the thing about Bill, I think, based on this conversation, is that, you know, he comes from a commercial background but has always worked with these strange, often difficult characters. He's kind of the straight guy who can hold the thing together so that it can be delivered, but also doesn't want to chase away the sort of slightly anarchic spirit of what makes our television really good. And the reason that I keep going back on this show is that I think we are missing some of that at the moment in our current media environment for reasons which are entirely understandable but still don't make it right that our product lacks for it. And I recognize that it's harder to do nowadays for a myriad of reasons. But that's why I love doing these conversations periodically with someone who's been around and seen a few things from different angles. And yeah, I really, really enjoyed this conversation with Bill Kerdin on the occasion of Greenstone's 30th birthday on Fold. Tēnā koe, Bill Kerdin. Welcome to the Fold.
Greetings, Duncan Grieve.
So excited about this. I wanted to do it for a long time. And in part because you've got this career that spans five different decades, multiple eras and kind of passages to it. And I feel like there's just so much to dig into there. So I'm just gonna roll right into it. I love the fact that you sort of started when it almost like a germ seed of the commercial media in New Zealand with the deregulating radio industry. You know, up until then, the vast majority of our media was on some level government-owned and controlled. Tell me about those first jobs and the sort of atmosphere for people who were building this thing out from almost nothing.
Well, it was tremendously exciting for me to start in FM radio in 1984 when I left school. A message had come around art history where I was studying with Willie Davis, the actor, and Greg Mayer, who went on to become a famous TVNZ producer. And they were looking for a trainee copywriter. So I went down, took the interview, got the job. And that was sort of where everything started. But prior to that, all you had was the local government-owned station, which was called Radio Northland. This is Whangarei.
Yeah, right.
So Radio Northland was the local government-owned station, and that's all we had. It was mono.
And what are you hearing? Like how much you're a school kid, you're into music. How much of you is in that product?
How do you mean?
Like how much did it feel creative for people like yourself?
The new station or the FM?
The original.
Yeah, because, well, up until that point, the music that you heard on the radio was all mono, and here was this new thing that was stereo and was going to play more sort of modern music. It wouldn't go as far as Joy Division, but, you know, it was playing, you know, the sort of the newer stuff that we were all into. And to be led into that world was just such a revelation for a country boy. You know, our record collection at home, Mum and Dad had ABBA Arrival, which I wasn't that into, and they had Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass and some compilation records and not really anything else. So in those days, you know, if you wanted to know anything about the international or local music scene, it was just radio with pictures. I couldn't afford to buy the NME or the Melody Maker or even Rip It Up, really, even though, you know, that stuff was around. So I just walked straight into this whole colourful world where there was a big room, as big as this one we're in now, full of records that I could play whenever I wanted, with all these grown-ups who were smoking pot.
Amazing. And so you started as a copywriter, and you stayed in radio more or less for probably 15 or so years after that, maybe even a little longer. What was it about the medium that sort of got you, and how did you kind of move from that initial kind of foot in the door deeper into it?
Into radio?
Yeah.
I think I travelled through different radio stations because I've always been quite easily bored. Once I'm somewhere and I'm doing something that's going really well, generally I start getting itchy feet and I want to know what's next. That's why television suits me, I think, so well, because our contracts tend to be 4 or 5 months tops, and then we move on to something else, and I love that. Like, I could never work on a show that's necessarily the same show year in, year out, although I kind of have, yeah, as well.
So you got the start in New Zealand and kind of this kind of crash course in a just-born industry. Then you moved to Northern Ireland, this much more sophisticated market, much closer to the beating hearts of culture, but also the Troubles is going on at the same time.
Yeah.
Just tell me about how you got there and what you found when you did.
classic young man's plan. I was must have been 22, and I thought, I know, I've done a few years in radio. I've got a bit of, you know, some skills. I've been a DJ, I've been a copywriter. I've done okay in this fully deregulated, saturated market. I'll go to the UK where it's not deregulated, where there's 60 million people, and I'll get a job over there. And it was impossible. I wrote to every single radio station in the British Isles and got flat rejections. I should have kept them all. There were so many. But I got one back from Northern Ireland where they were setting up a brand new FM station and they were looking for a more sort of a cosmopolitan kind of feel. So we had a Scottish guy. We had a whole bunch of different people there. And they, for some unknown reason, felt that an Antipodean accent might work quite well on the station. So they said, come over, we'll pay for your flight. I flew over and there was some to-ing and fro-ing. And they said, we'll get you to start a few weeks before the station goes to air. And that's what I did.
And the on-air aspect of it, because typically you've worked behind the scenes, is that fair to say? I mean, obviously you've done a lot of narration. It's a very familiar voice. But what did moving to that side of things kind of suit you?
Going from copywriting to being a DJ?
Yeah.
I don't know, but I wanted to be a DJ. Being a copywriter was great, but I wanted to be a DJ because, you know, I'd heard all these. I remember when I was probably 15 or 16, the two FM stations in Auckland opened up, which was 91 FM and 89 FM, which became Triple M. And they were both FM stereo radio stations playing pop and kind of rock. And our farm at the north of the Kuiperä, I could actually pick them up on my little stereo. So I was listening all the time to these great DJs, you know, playing this great music and this amazing world down in Auckland I hadn't even been to. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to be what those guys were.
Right.
So when I got the chance at the first radio station I worked at in Whangarei to be a DJ and do my first graveyard shift, I jumped at it, you know, and I stayed doing it for quite a few years.
In terms of the, you know, in Northern Ireland at the time, that was a place of, you know, real unrest. Did that ever sort of seep into the day job?
Yes. It was still quite dangerous then. When I told Mum and Dad that that's where I was going, they were like, well, that's that then. You know, you might as well be going to Iraq. Or somewhere like that, you know.
And laugh. It was legitimately low.
It was still quite dangerous. And I'll tell you a story about that. When I first got there, I didn't know anybody. I didn't know really anything. And John Ryan, my friend from London, came over to visit for the weekend. I'd been there about 2 weeks. And I had a car. And so I said to John, let's go up the Falls Road, man, and the Shankill Road. Let's go up and have a look because we've seen it on TV our whole lives in the news. Let's go check that out. So we jumped in my car and we drove up the Shankill, drove down the falls, you know, to see the military vehicles and the guys with
this
the guns.
This is effectively the sort of border, the quite militarized border between Northern
Ireland.
Yeah,
there's one, they're both very, they were quite sort of seriously dangerous areas. One was Catholic, one was Protestant. I couldn't even tell you which was which. But we drove up and down there and John was hanging out the window taking photographs of all these, you know, all the stuff, all the paintings on the walls and the light armored vehicles and the soldiers and stuff. And on the Monday I went to work and my boss, John Paul, said, how was your weekend? You know, how are you getting on? How are you fitting in? I said, great, man. We went up the Shankill and the falls and took some photos and here they are. And he just went white as a sheet and said, okay, at lunchtime we're going to go to the pub and I'm going to tell you about this place and what you do and don't do. Because if you do that, if you drive up and down those roads as a young man in a car taking photos, someone's going to think that you're taking photos for a particular reason.
Yeah.
And you'll get shot.
Just in case.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. He said to me, if the wrong person saw you doing that, you would have been followed, pulled over, and you would have had a bullet put through your kneecap, just to be sure, you know. Yeah. So that was a crash course.
That's terrifying.
But apart from that, you know, you didn't really see, if you knew where to go and where not to go, I just loved it there and I still have fantastic memories, very fond memories of Belfast. Great people.
So after that you moved to what you know, in my mind as one of the kind of the pivotal roles in your career, but equally a really important era for a really important organization in this country's media history, which was BFM in the sort of in the 90s, effectively. And you had a couple of different roles there. Started out making commercials, which were, they were so much a part of the station's identity and its posture, its brand, that you had the DJs and you had the music, obviously, but they felt such a huge differentiator for it. Where did was that sort of pre-existing, or did you sort of start to build that?
No, it was pre-existing. It was pre-existing, and basically, when I started there in the early 90s, it was the same place, but I felt like it was not. I felt like it was sort of unpolished, in a good way, and I felt that it could be more than what it was. So with my commercial background, I became production manager, and the commercials probably became just more and more dynamic. I don't know. But I always thought from the commercial background is if you have six, like we did, 6 or 7 minutes an hour of commercial, you know, that's your inventory. You can't just give that away to Adrian and John from Magnus Benro. In my mind,
icons.
Even though they're icons, you know, I have a copy background. I would always consider that 6-7 minutes, whatever it is, in a commercial hour, to be extremely important, because you don't want people switching off. It's got to be this symbiotic thing. So, yeah, we went out of our way to make those commercials as entertaining as possible to sort of support what else was going on air. But it wasn't. I didn't do it. It was Bob Kerrigan mostly.
Are there any sort of that stand out, whether they're sort of incidents that flowed out of it or creative that felt like it sort of summed up the ethos of that particular moment?
Shall I tell you the Karen Walker story?
Let's hear the Karen Walker story.
Poor old Karen. Honestly, what she had to put up with. She'd advertised on the station because, you know, it was fitting. And her empire was just beginning, and she was a really, really good supporter of the station. But there'd been something happened where Mikey called her and continued to call her a horse on air. This is one of our key advertisers. And there was this appalling situation where one of the sales team, and I think it was Josh Hetherington, had to go down and meet with Karen and explain to her that he'd had a meeting with Mike and the station management, and that he couldn't guarantee, he would try not to, but he couldn't guarantee that he wouldn't continue to refer to her as a horse, which caused all sorts of problems. And that was sort of typical of how we behaved at that time, just appallingly. And even myself, I remember one time we'd done one of our infamous breakfast buses where we'd get a double-decker bus and all pile on and broadcast around town from it. And I'd forgotten that Karen and her partner, Mikhail, had arranged to do a commercial with me at 9, and I turned up at 10, steaming drunk, and went into the studio, and there they were, and she was not happy, which is fair enough. And, I asked her if she'd like a drink, and I spilled some, and it was just awful, just so unprofessional. But also at the same time, we knew what we were doing as far as being creatives.
Do you think there was a way, because that the station in that era and a bit beyond had a reputation as being a sort of, it was very alternative, very creative, but also quite boysy and not necessarily a great place to be a woman, and that sort of Karen story speaks to that a little.
Yeah.
Do you think there was, you know, when you look back on it, do you sort of feel like there was a way of having that creative license there without having that atmosphere, that ambience that was, you know, like the good of it without the some of the negatives of it, is, I guess, what I'm asking.
We didn't think about it like that. We just didn't think about it at all, I don't think. I mean, we were all – certainly I admit it was a boys' club for sure, but there were girls in the boys' club, you know. Noel McCarthy was one of the boys. Wendy Adams was one of the boys.
But you had to be one of the boys as a woman.
So I guess probably what I'm saying is that just because you were a woman, you weren't going to be treated any differently, you know. But certainly, looking back on it, it definitely was a boys' club, and it would have been exclusionary, most definitely.
The other thing that sort of sticks out in terms of your roles, you know, it was that time as program director during the time when it assembled this kind of outrageous roster of talent that flowed through various shows, much of which are still kind of around New Zealand's media today. How heavily involved were you with that? And because, you know, as you just alluded to, there was the, you kind of need to be tight but loose with mm-hmm. with the talent to get that, the get all that out of it. Mm-hmm. What was that?
Becoming program director, it sort of coincided with the station flourishing. I'm not saying I had anything to do with it necessarily. It was just a lot of really interesting, great people in the same place at the same time, into all the same stuff. But I did see an opportunity when I took over from Graham Hill to really embed and start playing all those great 90s bands that you can think of, you know, the Soundgardens and the Pumpkins and all that stuff, and just push out the accepted boundaries, I guess.
There was always a bit of a tension with B, right? Like, you know, how indie should it be,
yeah.
You know, and by expanding that boundary a little and kind of formalizing it a bit while not chasing the sort of fringy stuff away, you can, the business can just be that much more consequential while still retaining its true character.
I had the advantage of coming from inside, so I'd already been there for a couple of years, so people knew me, and I started pushing out further, but wanting to keep that line. I just wanted to sell our product to more people, basically. I wanted more people to be into it because I was so into it and we were all so into it. So that's really all that happened. But it was playing that music, just pushing that out, the grunge, I guess, taking advantage of that because no one else was.
Mm.
The first thing I did was throw Mikey on Breakfast, and it just went from there. It just got bigger and bigger and became more and more fun, and I think we probably got more and more arrogant maybe and out of control and aggressive. I don't know.
But there was a sort of a market for and a license to have that, which, because you had, you know, in parallel, you know, you're sort of 10 years or so into a more deregulated, more licentious kind of atmosphere, and then an alternative culture was needed in some ways to sit alongside that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, Mikey does feel like the emblematic talent of that era, and we'll talk about him on television a bit more shortly. What was it about him and his approach? Because that felt like if you are trying to figure out when the peak of BFM's influence was, it was that period. What was it about him and the way that he went about things that had that, but kind of crossed over a bit, I suppose?
Well, he was so bombastic. I mean, you can't not like Michael, you know. I'd first met him actually years before that. I was working, I'd come home from Northern Ireland for a summer because I just had done with the weather. And I flew home for a few months. And I was working at a radio station in Tauranga called Coastline FM. And Push Push were big right then. And I remember they were coming to the station and he came bounding up the stairs. He was just this ball of energy. And that's who he is. He's a really unusual guy. There'll never be another Mike, you know. And I guess there was certainly some pushback from some quarters at BFM that he was going to be put on the Breakfast Show, which was the big show. But I didn't give a shit. I just knew that he meant, you know, people would tune in. You know, I mean, if you think about your classic student radio DJ, that's not it.
No. Well, and even the fact that Push Push is not a BFM band by any means.
No. But he'd had a number one single.
Yeah.
On both sides of the Tasman.
Absolutely.
That's not nothing.
It's not nothing. It's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
So, there, you know, along with the host, there were these sort of generations of artists, and you just referred to some of them, which became crucial, like local and internationally. You know, when we were talking earlier, you talked about, because BFM got them first. That's the whole point of BFM. Mm. Some of that sense of brushing up against talent and being very aware that this thing is a rocket and you're watching it take off, essentially. Do you want to just talk about maybe any specific artists or kind of, you know, whether it's receiving a record or a tape or something where you're just like, you're very conscious that you're holding this thing that's just about to explode?
There's so many examples of that. It was just almost like a daily thing. At a certain I remember Paul Masters from Virgin Records coming in one time, and he had this new single from the Smashing Pumpkins called Set the Rate of Jerry that no one had in the world. And he gave it to me and said, there you go. That's not out for 2 weeks. Stuff like that. Chemical Brothers, you know, we had a Chemical Brothers remix that no one had heard at all apart from them. And there was this one time we got an audio cassette, and it was Dave Grohl's Foo Fighters demo album. Well, I think it was the finished album, but he'd made like a dozen of them and sent them around the world to places where he thought it might be appropriate. And we got one. And we, you know, found the singles on the album and started playing them like hell because we knew that eventually they would hit the market. And I threw it away.
Just such an embarrassment of riches. What would that be worth now?
It really was. And of course, being the program director, I was always getting these cool things from record companies, little special pressings and this and that. I don't even know where any of them are. I've got one. It's an REM box set that's probably a little bit valuable, but I gave it all away to the guys.
When you look at BFM now and it's in this situation where it's having to sell a bunch of you know, what remains of that, you know, how do you, and I suppose you must be in touch with other former you know, people from that era, how does it kind of make you feel, and do you think there is another path for the organisation?
I don't know, because I don't have anything to do with it anymore. And of course, we, you know, me and the other old timers, we do talk sometimes about it and what's happening. But by and large, I don't have anything to do with it. And because I think it's really important that you recognise your time there as your time, and then you move on, and it's someone else's time, and they'll do what they have to do to stay afloat, I guess. I hope they do.
Yeah, it's very hard to just retain that connection to culture when the sort of means of distribution has changed so radically. Mm. That, just to return to Havoc and Newsboy, you know, that was also, you know, that duo became your entry into television as a medium. And there's something kind of shocking, less so in hindsight, but certainly at the time, the idea that you would have something that, you know, bombastic, I think is a good word, that would land on TVNZ, you know, this, which was, you know, kind of the establishment in a lot of ways. Is there a particular kind of episode or moment in the filming of it that stands out as kind of really crystallizing that juxtaposition and how strange it was?
Mike, well, first of all, you know how Mike ended up there. Neil Roberts was a friend of his. Neil Roberts was head of television, and that's how Mike ended up there. At one point, Mike was tossing up between Jeremy Wells and another guy, Jason Hall, who he used to call the Rock Pig, as being his co-host. He ended up choosing Jerry, and the pair of them started off. And then the show went for a while, I think it was 2 or 3 years, and then Mike and Jeremy and Paul Cassidy and Jill, the producer, all had this falling out, I think, and everything just collapsed in a spectacular fashion, and then that's when I came on board. So I had no real experience at all in television production, at all, but I did know Mike and Jerry pretty well from the radio days, and radio was pretty much, I was done. So that's how that all started. Are you wanting me to tell you a story about?
I guess about the show, because I feel like on some level, like perhaps because of the participants, it feels almost not forgotten, but certainly not as present in the memory as shows like Eating Media Lunch or yeah. Moon TV even. And yet the sort of permission system that allowed those to exist, a lot of it started with Havoc.
Yeah. Well, there was nothing like Havoc on TVNZ prior to that. That's I would say. Nothing that anarchic,
yeah,
and undefined and just haphazardly put together. We would literally have an idea in the morning and shoot it in the afternoon and cut it, and often will pretty much always go beyond when we were supposed to deliver.
You talked, you know, when we were speaking before about a trip to Ibiza that sort of seemed to sum up just how much of a strange license the show and Mikey had to kind of go and do things.
Yeah, he talked Red Bull into paying for some of that, and I think Qantas picked up the airfares and TVNZ paid for some, and we flew over. There was just me and Mike and our cameraman, Mark Chamberlain, and we spent 3 weeks filming a half-hour show. I mean, it was just outrageous, really. we had a four-bedroom villa with a pool up in the hills on the old side of the island above the old town, and that was sort of... that was me thinking, what am I doing in showbiz? This is mad. I remember one night my wife was at home here in New Zealand, and we had our son who was about a year old, year and a half, and our daughter Molly was still in her puku. And I remember standing outside looking at the pool and the view with the villa and Mike and these girls he'd met and all these people and the booze and everything else. And I'm on the phone to Fee, and she's saying, how's it going? I said, oh, it's all right, you know. I wish I was home with you. And that was, but that was just stuff like that would happen, not like that, but the show just did its own thing, and I just hung on, really. I feel looking back. Did you ever see the show WKRP in Cincinnati, the sitcom?
I'm aware of it. I didn't really.
It's a classic 70s, 80s sitcom about radio. And there's a character in there, Andy Travis, who was the program director. And he's the sensible one who tries to hold everything together while this chaos is going around him. I'm that guy. I was that guy at BFM and I was that guy on The Havoc Show. I tried to hold everything together and I held on and kind of made sure everything got there at the right time.
Does it strike you as strange when you think back at there and then sort of flash forward to today that the sui generis talent that is Mikey Havoc is, you know, pretty much invisible, whereas his sidekick, who's brilliant, but Jeremy Wells has now got the, you know, one of the, or two of the biggest jobs in the country.
Mm.
Do you have a theory as to why it sort of played out that way?
I don't know. I actually couldn't tell you. I mean, every person must be in control of their own destiny, and Mike went that way and Jerry went that way.
The Fold is brought to you by oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa, with over 4,000 out-of-home advertising sites nationwide across both street furniture and retail centres. I'm super grateful to oMedia for enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
So from there, that was your sort of entry into television, and then you became part of this, you know, it's Greenstone's 30th anniversary. You go into this world of sort of obs docs, factual, you know, whatever, you know, reality TV, whatever you want to call it. And there's this incredible run going through Neighbours at War, into that it's still going to, not Neighbours, but the relationship to this day in a way. Do you want to just explain why you moved from that sort of channel, which you could have sort of stayed in forever because there were shows that came out of that group that sort of I'm sure would have had you, but you picked this new path and created probably at least a clear decade of some quite iconically strange but also incredibly popular shows in that sort of broad genre.
I never take the work that I get offered for granted, ever. I'm always thrilled when someone rings me, and generally people who know me will tell you that if someone asks me to do something, I'll generally do it. So when I got the phone call from Greenstone, I don't think I had a show happening right at that moment, but when Andrea Lamb phoned me and said, would you like to come in and have a chat about this show we've got coming up, I went in there and she said, would you like to do it? And I said, yeah. So I will generally take whatever is being offered to me if I think that I can. I've obviously turned stuff down in the past. Yeah. I mean, a classic example would be the All Blacks documentary series that they did
with Amazon. Waters.
Yeah,
yeah.
I turned that. Well, I sort of walked away from it quite quickly. So there's some stuff that I will turn down because I know I can't do it or I don't really have an interest. But I'll generally say yes to whatever's happening and then see how it turns out.
Well, obviously you like this well enough to stick around for a long time. How quickly with Neighbours at War, which, you know, I consider, if you're trying to tell the story of New Zealand television and have some kind of unruly canon that represents it, Neighbours at War should be right up there to my mind. How quickly did you realise that there was something quite special in this format and that it expressed a very particular kind of New Zealand aesthetic and vernacular?
When I started, because I'd come from the Havoc world, I wanted to do a good job in that genre. I wanted to be, because making, you know, obstock reality television is actually quite difficult to do it well. It looks easy, but it's actually not, especially when you're doing the field direction. And I wanted it to be good. And the first season, looking back at that, is quite pedestrian. And I'm doing all the things I think I should be doing. But as always, season two, season three, I become bored. And I wanted to kind of, because it was reality TV, I wanted it to parody itself and become kind of absurd. I don't really know. I mean, if you want to call it something, I might have called it mockuality, but it was just, I just wanted to turn it upside down and make it New Zealand, like really New Zealand.
And that's what it feels like. You've got these characters, and I think that's what Guy Williams is trying to do with New Zealand today, is just, it gets harder over time as people get more sort of guarded and self-conscious and the internet changes everything. But you had this golden run. Is there like a kind of a classic grouchy, slightly strange personality that tended to maybe rub up against a similar one, or one who just wasn't going to accept it, that generates a lot of these conflicts? Is there a particular episode that stands out from that sort of season 2-3 era where you're like, oh, this is really going to go? Because it became immensely popular. Like, you were talking about 50% of the viewing audience at times.
Something like that, yeah. It was really popular. The third season, I think, was when it really hit its straps. But there was, I remember, and Guy Williams was obsessed with this one. There was a couple I'd met down in Māngere who, I've told this story before, but they lived next door to a Fijian Indian family. Their cat had disappeared and other cats in the neighbourhood had been disappearing. And because they were Fijian Indian and they were Muslim, naturally this couple suspected that they were eating the cats.
Jesus Christ.
I don't know how they got to that. But anyway, I went down to meet with them and had a chat to them and sort of looked at the lie of the land, if you like, and noticed a few things. And I thought, yeah, we'll probably do a story on this one. And then driving back to the office, that's when I really knew that the show could be a hit, because just it was so outrageous to put on air what they were thinking with and saying with straight faces.
Yeah.
And just ordinary people. The other thing that Guy loved about that episode was Rosemary, who sent me Christmas cards for years afterwards. She said to me she really wanted to visit her sister in Taranaki somewhere, and she also said she'd always wanted to go to Orewa. I was like, these are the people who should be on television. You know, certainly it's great having worthy documentaries and people who've done amazing things, but why not her?
Well, you're right, because it almost flipped the theory of television. The kind of Reithian idea was it was very kind of paternalistic in some ways, and New Zealand was a particularly, because of the level of state control, it had a particular kind of investment in that. And that strand, you know, motorway patrol, the, you know, renters, bogans, gutsful, what you worked in sort of seems to quite gleefully flip that on its head. And, you know, and on some level that was a thesis. Do people want this? And it turned out they massively did. You know, and looking back, it kind of wraps together pretty well. How did you go sort of to build that out, or who were the sort of key architects of it in terms of the with Greenstone and the networks? Like, because like it really did become quite a superstructure in a way.
Tony Manson, who is the commissioner at TVNZ, the wonderful Tony Manson, He was probably one of my greatest champions. But everyone at Greenstone was behind it. They knew it was a hit. So everyone worked really hard on it and was, you know, critical to the production of the show. All I did was go do the field direction, bring it back and cut it with an editor.
And narrate it.
And narrate it.
Which is pretty crucial because that tone, the very even tone of your narration is a big part of why it doesn't feel cruel, where a different tone there could really change the feel.
I don't know. I mean, I just do it. I didn't do it to do anything. I did the guide track and Tony said, you should do it. So I did it.
When you look back on that sort of pantheon, you know, shows like Renters, was there ever a tension or when you look back, do you sort of go, were we laughing with or at, you know, these people and wondering about how it sort of impacted their lives? Because it was quite a different, the media has become a lot more self-conscious about its impact subsequently in a way that it wasn't at that time.
There's a line I'll never cross with making television where I feel that line is just how I feel. But there's a line I'll never cross with people because I want them to retain their dignity. And over the four seasons I did of Neighbours at War, for example, we only really had one complaint from someone that I filmed with.
Interesting.
And she was very upset. Everyone else saw themselves on TV and said, that's it, that's great. That's the story, that's who I am. And I've always, and it probably goes right back to my radio days and my first boss, Paul Colcord, who told me how you broadcast and how you connect with the audience through the microphone. It doesn't matter whether it's through a page or a camera, it doesn't really matter. You have to know who your people are and you have to connect with them by knowing who they are.
So when you moved beyond Neighbours at War, what was the next show that where you felt really sort of invested in it and why was that?
I think all of them to some degree. I like doing them all. I mean, it's just so many. I'm just trying to think. Some of the more difficult ones, like the international ones, like Redwood Kings for Animal Planet, were harder to make and you feel more invested in those ones sometimes just because of the sheer scale of them and the process of reduction. And yeah, they're much more difficult to make than some of the obstocks that I have made. But I'm invested in all of them. The one I was doing this morning, you know, the one I'm cutting right now at home, I'm fully invested in it, you know, and I can't wait for my editor to watch it and see what I've done and see what he can add to it because it's brilliant, you know.
What is it about the sort of the observational factual space that has gripped you? Because this might, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like the longest single period of time that you've worked in a particular medium or with an organisation. What is it about it that kind of keeps you endlessly satisfied, I suppose?
It's like a puzzle. You get the raw and you have to fashion it into something. So every day you're getting a block of raw footage and it's up to you. You have to fashion it into something for someone else to take over and polish it up. And that's what I love. It's like being paid to do a puzzle every day. I still enjoy it.
When we spoke before, you mentioned having worked briefly on Married at First Sight, which is this blockbuster, right? Yeah. But you said it sort of drove you crazy. You couldn't hack it on that one.
There was that one in The Bachelorette, or was it The Bachelor, or whatever, at Warner's. And you know, of course, thank them for asking me to do the jobs. But I just couldn't get – I didn't care, you know.
Why is that? Because they're on – superficially, people might consider them similar shows, but there must be on some fundamental nature that for you they don't line up.
They're constructed reality. So those shows, you're putting people in a position and they're going to perform and you're going to create a bin with extreme close-ups of people raising their eyebrows or looking left and right, and then you're going to make what you want to make out of it. And it is what happens, but it is constructed reality and that's different. I don't get into that. It feels like it's just not what I like to do, really.
Do you watch it or is it just no part of it?
My wife does. She loves it.
So do I.
Do you?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
No, it is. I mean, look, I have huge admiration for the people that make those shows because they're so hard to make. They really are. They're not easy to make and they have to make them really quickly and there's a lot riding on it, but it's just not my bag.
Yeah, I just reeled off that list of shows. There's not as many of them now and the sort of atmosphere that commissioned them and enjoyed them, the whole television environment's changed. Do you feel like But some of that, to me, like beyond the sort of technological and behavioural, there is also a licence to kind of be a bit more roguish than is typical now. Do you feel like, how does that change manifest? Is that in notes or is that in a show ending the way that Neighbours at War did? Or is there, is it just the culture moves on?
I don't know.
Like, do you feel like, as a sort of a practitioner, that the environment that you're operating in from a where the license, you know, the Overton window of it in a way, do you think that that has changed?
Yeah, it probably has. But I don't, I mean, I stay out of all of that stuff. I'm just the guy that they sometimes might get to do some work on a particular show. I do think sometimes there aren't enough risk takers.
That's what I'm getting at, essentially.
There aren't enough dangerous, unpredictable people. I'm not saying I am, but in the wider industry, I feel like they've either systematically been deleted or they've left. And in that business of radio, television, whatever, if you don't have those people who may be difficult, may be difficult to control, if you don't have them, your business model is, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
For an example,
yeah.
When I was at BFM and when I was at TVNZ, there was always these problems with Mikey being late. And I would say, yeah, I know. And I can't actually drive over to his house and get him out of bed. Shall we get Dominic Bowden? And he will always be on time. And that was my point. Dominic's a great guy, great broadcaster, but
he's not Mikey Havoc.
Yeah. You have to have people with the X factor. I know exactly what it looks like. I don't have it, but I know what it looks like. And I don't think there's that much X factor rolling around as much as there used to be. I don't know.
That's really interesting. So the most recent project, major project you've worked on, you know, you were telling me about it yesterday, and it sort of sounds almost unbelievable. Yeah, it's Billy Corgan, who you've had a lot to do with from another angle, much more distant relationship. At BFM. Just tell us about this project, what you've been doing, how it came about, because that also speaks to how this sort of industry and the reality of working in it has changed.
There's a guy called Ben Frost who actually did work at Greenstone on Renters years ago. He moved on from there. We actually worked together sort of on The Food Truck. I did some script editing for that and he edited it here in New Zealand. He's Australian. He went to LA and has done very well for himself. He's a executive producer at a big company called Nacelle over there in LA. And he, through some other contacts, he emailed me and said, look, probably don't remember me, but we sort of floated around each other a bit. Oh, this is what I'm doing now. We've had this show commissioned about Billy Corgan. He's bought the National Wrestling Alliance. It's not doing that well. We're going to make a show about him, his family, his band, and what he gets up to. Are you interested? And I was. Who wouldn't be? I said, but I do live in New Zealand. He said, don't worry, we'll do it all remote. And so Greenstone very graciously allowed me out of a contract a little bit early, and I went and did that for the second half of last year. And it was a really different experience because I was supervising producer, which meant I had a group of story producers creating stuff for me, which I would work on, hand on to editors, hand back. So it was a really busy production, but yeah, a great experience. And again, I just said yes. And you just see what happens.
You mentioned, again, when we spoke before, that you thought that the fact that you can work on a show remotely was going to be a challenge to the local screen production industry, which previously, you know, if you were here, you're working here. Do you want to just expand on that thought?
I can rattle off a whole list of Kiwi editors, very good Kiwi editors, who aren't working for anyone in New Zealand. They're doing it remotely. One of our editors on the Billy Corgan show, Lisa Greenfield, who's extremely gifted editor from K Road, she was working remotely, traveling around Europe, Italy. I think she's in Hungary once. And she said to me, "This is normal. We do stuff for internationals all the time. US dollars, time zones are a bit different, but I do wonder. I do hope that we don't lose too many people to that, because we could. You know, if you think about the UK, there are plenty of productions up there that would benefit from having someone beavering away down here while they're all asleep.
Yeah, yeah, you can really see that. Lastly, let's kind of, you know, because it's Greenstone's 30th birthday, it'll be last Friday when this airs. What was it about that company that has enabled it to persist and create this whole basket of shows that collectively display a kind of rugged form of New Zealand, like a kind of quote-unquote real New Zealand that might have been anathema to the sensibilities when they started to make them, but that have, I think they've made a real contribution to kind of capturing a particular kind of person in a particular kind of era.
Greenstone is my marae. I keep coming back to it, and I hope it stays kind of as it is. But I think some people have a little uncharitably called it the library in the past because it's quiet and nothing ever really dramatic happens there. And that may be because it's overwhelmingly populated by strong, intelligent, creative, no-nonsense women who know how to handle a production, know how to handle idiots like me, and know how to make things work. That place just always ticks along like a Rolls Royce. It really does. And I think that no matter what show they make there, it always gets done on time, on budget, with a minimum of fuss, and as a good product. And I reckon that's partly why. It's because, it's because of the people that are there, but it's that's probably part of it, I reckon.
Well, it's been so good to have you up here and to kind of explore that. What feels like it's not a vanished era, but certainly like it's one that I think really deserves to be contemplated, especially on an occasion like this. So thank you so much for coming up, Bill. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, mate. I've had a good time.
That was The Fold, brought to you by our partners at oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Huge thanks to oMedia for sponsoring this episode of The Fold and enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today. The Spinoff Podcast Network.